Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. Straight to the point, no fluff, and no BS, this show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, please visit exomountaingear.com. Welcome, this is episode 98, and we're speaking with Aaron Davidson of Gunworks. So this is another episode to kind of continue with the Building a Backcountry Rifle series that we did earlier this year. We picked it up with episode 97 again, just our last episode with Ryan Kleckner. And now here we are with the Building a Backcountry Rifle series continuing, talking about something very specific, and that is long-range hunting. So that is obviously a hotly debated topic, or at least it can be. It's something that, honestly, Steve and I have no experience with. I mean, we weren't rifle guys very much when we started this Building a Backcountry Rifle series. We were curious about long-range hunting, wanted to learn more, not only the philosophy, but also skills and gear and kind of what sets the long-range hunters apart, maybe why they do it, how they do it, and what all of us should know, really, about longer-range hunting with a rifle. So Aaron was the perfect guy to talk to about that. You are definitely going to enjoy this episode, and his perspective is incredibly valuable. I certainly learned from him and appreciated the knowledge he had to share. Before we get into that, I want to give a quick shout out to Jordan Ray for leaving a review on iTunes. Jordan, we want to send you some swag. Just send us your shipping address. We'll get you taken care of. Listeners, you can always enter to these giveaways by leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever else you might be listening to this. Or just send in your questions, comments, or feedback to podcast@exomountgear.com. We love hearing from you guys, hearing how we can make this podcast better, and really just hearing what you're up to. So whether you have a story to share, field photos, suggestions for the podcast, something you want to hear about, definitely let us know. Also, coming soon, episode 100. I've mentioned it before. We want to thank you guys for making this podcast a success. So episode 100 is really just going to be a giveaway. We're just going to give a ton of stuff away for you guys as a thank you for making this podcast happen and allowing us to get to episode 100. So you're going to have a chance to win an Exo Mountain Gear pack, gear from First Light, Tight Spot, Black Gold, Bow Sights, Heather's Choice, and many, many more. That's like not even half of it. So make sure you tune in, make sure that you are subscribed, and come on back for episode 100 here in just a couple weeks or so. Okay, let's get into this discussion about long-range hunting and rifle shooting with Aaron Davidson of Gunworks. Well, Aaron, thanks for joining us tonight. Appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about some long-range hunting topics.
Glad to be here.
So, Aaron, before we dive into anything technical and get deep, just go ahead and give us some background, some context. I'm sure that quite a few of our listeners are familiar with Gunworks, which you were the CEO of, but kind of give us the backstory on how you got into shooting and then what led to the development of Gunworks and what you guys have been up to over the past, what, little over 10 years?
Yeah, I've given the response to that question several times, so I've kind of got a little pat answer. But, I mean, really, for me, long-range hunting didn't evolve out of, you know, the need to shoot animals at a longer range. It came from, you know, where I was exposed to firearms in a big way, and it kind of paired up with my education, and kind of got excited about the gear and the science about the whole deal. And and it's still that way for me. I'm totally gear centric. It's for me, it's about the art and beauty of being able to put a bullet, you know, on a very small spot way out there. The answer to that question is when I went to college, I was a car guy, hot rods, Camaros, Impalas, the whole deal, you know, building motors. And I went to college to be an engineer and to grow up and work on cars one day. At the same time, I started a family, and I found out really quickly that a a really expensive hot rod pays for a lot of guns. And so I started selling cars and I started buying guns. And then that's what I did in my spare time, was set up guns and shooting and loading and all that stuff. And combined with that engineering exposure in my education, it really, you know, it clicked for me. It's something that resonated with me. That's really what got me into the long range. I graduated from college, worked for a couple years, and said, you know what? I'm going to do this thing. Started Gunworks, and I've looked back a couple times, but not that much.
Yeah. So Gunworks, I mean, you guys have a lot going on, from obviously the rifles to content to training. I mean, there's a lot that kind of falls under that umbrella these days, but I'm assuming you started just with the rifles. Is that right? Did you start now by, you know, modifying other factory platforms, or did you guys start out of the gate, you know, developing your own products?
You know, out of the gate, developing our own products. In fact, if you point all the way back to 11 years ago, you know, when we started putting this together, the focus was on building an enterprising company and developing new products and bringing new things to the market. And our stock that we currently use on the LR1000 model, that stock design and the science that we put into making that work the way that it does was there, you know, 10 years ago. It's the same stock.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah. That's awesome. So before we dive into those specific platforms, which we for sure want to cover, let's talk a bit about long range shooting, long range hunting. I mean, you kind of expressed your interest, and it's what I see a lot, in the sense that there are, you know, let's put it this way. Long range shooting, not necessarily just hunting, but just, as you mentioned, the art and the science of long range shooting, of putting a bullet down range in an extended distance with accuracy. I mean, there's something amazing about that. And so for a lot of guys, that carries over into hunting, for sure. But then there's guys who question long range hunting. I'm sure you've fielded the questions, heard the criticisms. For our listeners who either aren't informed well about long range hunting, or just have questions, maybe on the fence about what does that mean? What's really the point of long range hunting and stretching that distance for hunting scenario? Kind of walk us through some of those questions and help us understand long range hunting a little bit better.
Yeah, long range as a term is kind of a catch-22 for the past 10 years. Basically, whatever you want to sell, the guys that want to shoot way out there, you just paste long range in the front of it, and all of a sudden, it's, you know, marketing, that's your marketing baby term. Yeah, but at the same time, long range brings with it these connotations of, you know, too far, right? And I think if we go back and say, well, what exactly are we talking about when we say long range? And I would say it's where you start to compensate for the bullet's drop. And okay, for most cartridges, I mean, we're talking 250 yards, 300 yards. So when I say long range, basically what I'm saying, when you start shooting past that point blank, 250 to 300 yards, boom, you're in long range territory. 400, 500, 800 yards, I consider that long range.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's, yeah, as soon as you move out of that a dead hold, if you will, without any compensation, that makes sense for sure.
If you back up into, you know, given some context for you know, those guys and shooting and hunting at distance and being capable of harvesting at distance, you know, the real ethical question is, can I hit the target, and is it fair? I guess those are the two things that come up.
Mm-hmm. So obviously hitting the target is completely personal. I mean, it depends on your equipment, and certainly even more so depends on your skills. And we can get to that for sure. But what about that? What about that second question? Is it fair? How do you address that to guys who say, well, it's not even fair. It's not fair chase. The animal didn't have a chance to escape, if you will.
I love this one. It in fact, I would love to someday just get on a stage and debate somebody and just really, really hear the answers, and not, you know, not confrontational, just
to talk it through,
theoretical. Like, let's Intellectual debate. You know, what are the pros and cons? It is a really good question, and you know, when I got into guns, it was all about, you know, lever actions and open sights. I mean, my gun safe still has, you know, some old Continental rifles that were open sight kind of products, and it was Teddy Roosevelt, and it was, you know, my exposure and my passion and desire kind of focused in on those things. In fact, I took it so far as to, you know, when I first, you know, got into the gun thing, it was pistols. It was Elmer Keith, and you know, and it was using six guns to not just to shoot but to also hunt with, and you know, took a lot of animals with short-barreled open sight, you know, 44 magnums. And so I understand the idea about getting close, you know, used the bows. I've hunted with archery equipment, you know, had success and have some of my best hunting memories associated with that. But, you know, I've also grown up and got a job and, you know, and have to spend my time earning a living. I'm not, you know, 15 days in the field to harvest an animal. I also have higher expectations for success. And so my paradigms shifted just a little bit in, you know, in why I do these things. So when you come to that, is it fair question? First thing I would say, number one, is it ever ethical to take a shot at an animal that's aware or that's fleeing? Mm-hmm. You know, that's on the move. And you look at some archery stuff, it's like an animal can move out of the way before that arrow gets there. Is it ethical to take a shot at that animal that's aware of you and is ready to for that flight response? And so I would say, no, it's not ethical for that. You put most hunters in a situation where the shot is not ideal. And my favorite example is we've got one outfitter that hunts really great, big, huge mule deer, big deer, the kind of deer that just make you lose control of most brain functions. And their method of take was monster 3378 Weatherbys, and, you know, just to, you know, get that knockdown power or whatever. And they would try to get in close to these deer because the guys couldn't hit anything past 100 yards. So they'd try to get them in real close. They'd stalk in close and they'd be out in a sagebrush flat or something. Buck would jump up and, you know, there's a brief window where you could shoot, or maybe they miss that and the animal's on the move and it's shoot. And they would shoot eight, you know, 12, 16 times and finally, you know, tag that animal enough that it expired out of, you know, sheer, you know, desperation. It was brutal. And they filmed these hunts, and I've got video evidence. And that is, to me, that is the classic, you know, let's stalk that animal. And, you know, as soon as it's aware, you know, now we're, oh crap, that's as close as we're getting. Now let's figure out how to shoot, you know, no good rest, no good setup, you know, not a lot of time, and the adrenaline, right? That mental shut off that happens when there's adrenaline involved. And if you contrast that against the way that I've trained my own children to shoot, which is we're going to take one shot and we're going to make this shot count. And we'll take a stock into where we can set up, get comfortable, you know, take time to get steady, build up a rear rest in the back, you know, make sure that there's no possible error that you know, that could be induced because you're unsteady. You know, take time to dry fire, you know, take time to calm, you know, and you know, kind of focus and find that zen. And then, you know, when the animal presents the right shot, broadside shot with the best odds, then take that one shot, take that animal. Now, which one of those presents the ethics or the morality of a harvest that we should chase after?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it doesn't necessarily have to do about range. I almost say, you know, being out of the animal zone of awareness is the whole point. It's like, are we going to outlaw scent lock gear and scent control technology that tries to take us out of that animal zone of awareness? Right? Is that stuff unfair because now the animal can't smell us? Though I guess that to me, that argument of is it fair is almost a little bit silly. I think maybe what the argument that they're making it is I don't have that gun. I can't shoot that far. It's not fair that you do.
Yeah, I think it's a great point to make in the sense that there are 10,000 shots that I shouldn't take that you are probably capable of taking. And so I certainly hope it's not the guy who is who doesn't practice much, who picks up a box of shells 2 weeks before hunting season, who takes, you know, a rushed shot, maybe offhand at 100 yards. And then hopefully he's not the guy who's talking down to somebody who has equipment completely dialed, incredibly practiced, incredibly proficient. As you mentioned, taking the time to set up properly, and it might be shooting at longer range, but which is more effective, which is more fair to the animal, which is more sportsmanlike. You know, it, so much of it comes down to personal ability and then situational. And, you know, that's the thing with ethics. It's you can't quickly paint things in black and white because so much of it is situational for sure.
Yeah, and you know, I'm a little bit of a libertarian personally. I kind of tip towards the conservative side. I mean, I run a gun business, right? I'm definitely not leaning the other way. But I'll tell you what, truthfully, I don't think it's anybody else's business about how I decide to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If we start down that road, truly, if we start down the road of analyzing the ethics and the method of take and the, you know, the successful harvest percentage, you know, even to the point where maybe you have to take a test before you shoot, I guarantee you nobody's going to be doing any archery hunting anymore.
Hmm.
That whole call an elk in and stick an arrow in him, you know, somewhere, and then he runs off and you don't find him and like, well, you know, that one got away. Like, that whole thing's gone.
Hmm.
I think it's a slippery slope to start pointing fingers and criticizing, you know, anybody about what they believe is right, you know, and trying to impose your ideals. Man, that's starting to sound like a liberal mentality.
Yeah.
My idea is right. You need to kowtow and follow my idea of what's right.
Right.
Anyways, I'm a little more libertarian than that.
No, yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I think it's just helpful to talk through these things because, I don't know, I hate to see criticisms get launched when the topic's not fully understood, and so, you know, I want our listeners to have a chance to understand long-range hunting a bit better and understand where guys such as yourself are coming from.
I think the coolest, just real quick, I'll interject, the coolest thing about long-range hunting is you have to set up for long-range shooting. And the very first couple shots you take at a half mile hitting the steel or that paper plate or whatever, all of a sudden turns you into a long-range shooter, and it becomes a passion. And I have so many clients that we've sold rifles to that were those guys that take their gun out and, you know, they have five or six different brands of ammo, and they you know, they just take a couple shots. It hits the paper plate at 100, they say, I'm good to go. And they don't shoot at all. They don't practice. They're not familiar. So many of those guys turn into these people that are burning hundreds of rounds of ammunition a month in that quest for the perfect shot. And so I think the sport of long-range shooting has a lot more draw to practice than just, you know, hunting with a rifle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, I just wanted to put that in there.
No, yeah. No, that's a great point for sure. You know, effective range and what is ethical is personal based on those capabilities for sure. I'm curious, how do you, just kind of some of the elements that you consider when you're in the field, because you're a hunter yourself. I mean, you're not just this long range shooter, you are a hunter. What are some of those factors that you consider when you're evaluating a shot opportunity and you're sort of making that call on, you know, can I make this shot here? I mean, as you mentioned, your goal is one shot and a kill. You don't want to be lobbing bullets. So what are some of the factors in the field factors? Are they, you know, wind and rest and positioning? I mean, kind of talk us through how you evaluate a shot opportunity.
Sure. Well, the first thing right off the bat is for the past 10 years, every single hunt that I've been on has had a camera. So you think about that. It's like, not only, I mean, and every single one of these is intended to air in front of a big audience. So, I mean, think about the pressure of how important it is for me to make a great shot. And I'm not telling you that every shot that I've taken has turned out the way I intended it. But that documentation and that proof and showing and that pressure, and, you know, there's a little different aspect. So when I evaluate a shot, I mean, I truly am evaluating, can I make the shot? Not is there a chance, but is it going to happen? So it's funny, but confidence, you know, in a lot of sports, confidence is huge. I mean, that psychological game is a really big component of long range shooting, and understanding your rifle, your gear, and having confidence in the way it's going to perform is really important. So our whole business, the whole thing about Gunworks is about combining all the parts and pieces of a shooting system so that the user with very simple techniques does not have to worry about missing elevation. So if you have assembled your gear, and we'll get into that to whatever extent you want, if you've assembled your gear and you have all the right pieces and you've got the right techniques in place, what I'm saying is that for whatever shot it is you want to take, essentially you're not worrying about a miss vertically. So that's kind of that preparatory steps. So when I approach a shot, and I'm not talking about shooting 1400 yards animal, I'm talking about, you know, those sub 1000 yard realistic, you know, generally, you know, a long range shot could be that 700 to 800 yards where you feel like I can make this, let's set up and, you know, make this happen. I mean, once in a while, you get that opportunity that pushes farther where the conditions are right and the animal's right and everything comes together. But most of the time we're talking, you know, half mile type shots. And in that situation, you know, barring some crazy canyon vertical wind, which I've experienced, I've seen what can happen. You know, you don't worry about your vertical. And so it all comes down to your wind, truly, you know, and then executing those very basic principles that it takes to control that elevation. So if we break that down to some smaller things, when you set up with a rifle system, I never take a shot where I'm not steady. So you got to know what type of terrain, what type of contour, vegetation is going to allow you to set up prone. You know, some guys take some long shots with other equipment. For me, I get prone. So I figure out how to get prone. I'd rather back up another 200 yards and be prone than take an uncomfortable shot, you know, sitting or, you know, from some elevated sticks or whatever. So if I'm prone, first thing is the location, right? So first consideration, location. Next consideration is like my rest, my gear. A lot of guys like throwing guns on backpacks. Absolutely not. That doesn't work for me, and I don't think it's a good idea, because you can't consistently use that rest and get this same repeatable performance that you can off a bag. So I've got a bipod, and then I've got a small bag or something for the rear. So the first thing is to get the right location and then to get your gun on the right rest and get it steady. So if your gun's steady, I mean, how many of us can't break a trigger well when we're totally comfortable and the gun's absolutely rock solid, right? So I've won most of the battle right there. Then the next thing is just doing the fundamentals of correcting for elevation, which is, you know, good ranging techniques and then compensating for a good ballistic calculation. If you're using a computer, fine. You're using whatever methodology, that's fine, but correcting for that compensation. And truthfully, I believe if you're a serious long-range shooter, you're dialing that elevation. In a hunting condition, you know, you're inside 500 yards. Maybe you're using a reticle, but I think there's so many ways that can go wrong. psychologically or even just the physics of the equipment, that you're dialing the elevation. So you get a good elevation dial, and there's some things to worry about there. Your scope's got to have zero stop. You don't want to be multiple revolutions up. So there's some technique there, but you make that correct adjustment based on a good range and a good ballistic calculation. So that's the fundamentals that correct for that vertical, the elevation correction with no vertical error. Then the last thing comes in, which is like the killer. It's the deal killer in most situations. If there's no wind, we'd all be shooting 1,000 yards every time. That last element of wind and how the wind flows over terrain and how the wind, you know, it matches up with another wind and then how do I assess that, engage the speed with the limited tools that we have, and then making a good calculation with your solver, your computer, so that the only variable, the only question is, you know, what direction and how fast is it going? And generally, we can train people really quickly to understand direction. And so that's where we're at. If we back up 6 months before that, when the guy picked his cartridge and he started picking his gear, if you pick the right cartridge, you can minimize that wind deflection. And if you minimize that wind deflection, it can allow a rather large error in that speed guess. Right? So if you got the direction right, you might be able to be plus or minus 3, 4, 5 miles per hour and still make a perfect kill shot if you pick the right cartridge. So when I approach that situation, I mean, that kind of gives you a little bit of a walkthrough. And then obviously there's your shooting fundamentals, and there's just hours and hours, days and days of techniques and knowledge that, you know, needs to be distilled to understand everything. But that's the short version.
Yeah, for sure.
No, what's out of curiosity, what's the right cartridge? I know it's a long answer, but what for you, what is that?
Well, let's back up, and I'll put a disclaimer out there. We made the right cartridge 6 years ago. It's called the 7LRM. It's low recoil. It's awesome downrange performance, and it does everything that you need it to do. Now, does that sell guns? You know, an old six-year-old cartridge? No, it's the new cartridge that just was released this year, the super duper one. That's the one that sells guns, so that's the one people want to buy. So, or it's the one that their buddy shot or whatever. But the right cartridge is the one that gives you the least amount of wind deflection downrange and the least amount of recoil on your end, you know, mm-hmm. when you shoot it. I would say that's the right cartridge. Now, we want to shoot hunting weight bullets, and it's really important to look at how fast that bullet is traveling at impact. We call that the threshold velocity, the terminal velocity, you know, a couple things like that. Basically, that bullet needs to be going fast enough that it can still expand at that distance. Mm-hmm. And a really safe number is 2,000 feet per second. So if you want to shoot 1,000 yards, you can't pick a cartridge that's only going, you know, 1,600 feet per second at 1,000 yards. That's not going to kill ethically. It's not going to expand correctly. The bullet's going to tumble. It's going to steer. It's not going to penetrate straight through the animal. So, mm-hmm. so when you're looking at cartridge stuff, you know, the old school way to do it is how flat is it, right? And mm-hmm. we still see some guys releasing cartridges, you know, today. They're like, it's flat shooting. Flat doesn't matter. You got a rangefinder. You got a ballistic computer. It's like, we can calculate what the correction is. You dial it in. You shoot it. Doesn't matter. So flat shooting is kind of a red herring. What's really, really important is what's the wind deflection and how far is my threshold velocity going to allow me to shoot? Those are the things you use a ballistics program, you know, put your velocity, your BC in there, and it'll tell you. Basically, look for a cartridge that's got a BC around 600 and a velocity around 3,000 feet per second. And that'll steer you towards, you know, the right selection. You know, if you look at the range of bullets, you're going to get those BCs in reasonable weight bullets in the 7mm. So for that all around North American hunting cartridge, bears, you know, moose, elk, everything. That 7mm is going to do it. 168 to 180 grain bullet.
So let's take a average Joe hunter out there who is interested in becoming a more competent shooter, therefore more competent hunter, and maybe wants to have the capabilities to extend his range so that he ethically can have more shot opportunities. So if we paint with super broad strokes, there's two main factors to that. One being the skills, one being the person, and then two being the gear. So if we begin to dive into those two areas, and start with the skills, start with the shooter. You guys have educational offerings, which I'd love for you to kind of cover, and I know there's multiple courses, multiple stages to that. I'd love to hear about those, what you have to offer there, and then I'd also just love to hear how does this average Joe shooter begin to take practice more seriously and begin to improve? Like, what are the practical things that they can do from the guy who, you know, checks a 0 3 weeks before season to actually becoming a more proficient shooter?
I'll tell you what, again, it's contagious. If he could get set up behind a gun that is fun to shoot and pull the trigger on a target that's way out there beyond anything he's ever considered possible, and see that impact and hear that steel ring and know that, hey, I just did this, that will do more to inspire that person. It will do more to change that dynamic than any other thing that we can talk about. Because if he's really got it in him, that ring of steel is the call to action, and everything else becomes secondary, and he'll focus on what it takes. Now, I would say probably the biggest challenge that the average guy has is he's shooting a gun that kicks way too much, and it's got a piss poor stock design that hurts when you pull the trigger. That is the number one impediment. So I would say the first thing is, instead of grabbing your 300 Ultramag, get your 243 out. And let's start there. So number one, and 243 obviously is not my preference, but it's likely he's got one. The latest craze is the 6.5 Creedmoor, and for good measure, it's got some real street cred. 6.5 Creedmoor has very low recoil, so get out your small recoil gun, and let's talk about that gun and getting it set up. So the big obstacles to hearing that steel ring. You know, as far as like the guy shooting, it's like I can take anybody. In fact, I had president of the company that manufactures our rangefinder product here in Denver. He was up, and he never shot a gun in his life. I think 50s, you know, older, you know, I think he golfs good, so he gets the idea of a good shot. But he never shot a gun. Never shot a gun in his life, and he came up here, and we were making hits at 1,000 yards. So the techniques can be conveyed and instilled and very quickly as far as like what it takes to make a shot. You know, it's how to get a guy comfortable behind a gun and get that gun steady. If you do those things, it's like the couple other things you have to do to break that shot with the crosshairs on the target are easy. So again, if we've got a light recoiling gun, then the major barriers that guy's going to have to ring and steal is he's not going to know how to correct for the drop. He's not going to know how to do the ballistics component. And that really becomes that's the big part. So if you look at, say the guy's got his 270 Winchester and you know, he's got just a standard duplex scope with no turret adjustments, you know, how does he correct for the drop? So in our level one course that we teach, we do this kind of foundation, progressive, and then mastery type categories. But in that level one course, we'll essentially walk you through the whole gamut of equipment selection, ballistics calculations, trajectory validation, which is a key step, and kind of the basics, the fundamentals of shooting from a bench. And you know, if you think about that, if you went through that whole process, it's basically how to pick the right gear, how to set it up, and how to shoot it consistently and get that confidence to hear that steel ring. So if a guy's got that 270 Winchester, probably the biggest barrier he has is his optic, his scope. And let's say he makes the choice to spend some money and invest, you know, and he upgrades and he's put $600 or $1,000 into a scope that tracks well, that has repeatable adjustments. Then, you know, the next step for him is to collect the ballistic data that will allow him to make accurate calculations. So we've got some videos on our YouTube channel. I think there's 300 videos. One of them is called Trajectory Validation. So you'll basically shoot at a close range and a far range, and then you plug the numbers in our program. It'll tell you what the real velocity was for that manufacturer's BC to hit at that target. And it's a really crude or rough way to true that trajectory, but it's effective. And so now that guy has the BC and velocity number that he can plug in and calculate a drop chart. And then when he goes to that 800-yard target, he can take the MOA correction or MILRAD correction and adjust it into the scope. And now when he pulls the trigger, the bullet hits where it's supposed to go. And I would say that little process of assembling or creating, you know, the gear that can correct for the elevation is kind of where he needs to focus. I'm not a big guy about just saying, hey, just go buy the best gear and do this and that. I mean, that's what our business is all about. But it's like, I'm kind of more of a start where you're at, you know, make some good decisions on gear. Don't waste money. You know, what if that $800 scope's not good enough, but if you spend $1,900, you'll never, ever want another scope for the rest of your life. I almost would tell that guy to just save that little bit of extra and buy the best one. And so if he kind of understands on the gear selection where he needs to be, so you buy the best one or as good as he ever is going to need, and then, you know, use that gun out of his cabinet and just do the best that you can with it, understanding where its terminal performance limitations are. Just because you could only shoot animals at 650 yards doesn't mean you can't shoot targets at 800. You know, in 1,000, et cetera. So you can have a lot of fun practicing and training and developing skill. And then when you feel more like you know what you're, you know, where you're going to go with this and where it's going to develop to, then you can make some other purchase decisions and chase after a rifle upgrade. Maybe that rifle upgrade is just a Remington Sendero or a Remington Long Range in a 7 Rem Mag. Maybe that's the big upgrade. It's a good step. And Remington platforms are really nice one to piecemeal and customize as you go. So anyways, if I had to say where that guy needs to focus, it's on making and having an optics package that allow you to correct repeatedly for elevation and understanding the ballistics component and how to validate trajectories and do a good calculation.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah. We're getting back to just a little bit more of the practicalities before we move on to more of the gear, which we for sure want to talk about. Where do you see guys go wrong most often, and what can they be doing better technically? Your average shooter, average hunter who isn't trained.
You're talking in the shot or in his decisions?
In the shot for now. So in fundamentals, whether that be setup, whether that be, you know, trigger manipulation,
things of that nature. It's all in. He doesn't put a rear bag under the gun.
Okay. So walk us through
that. That's the most common. So if you can imagine a teeter-totter balancing on one point, and imagine how unstable that is, right? And then imagine instead of one point in the center of the teeter-totter, you put 2 points and spread them out to the ends. How steady is that going to be?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So if you have a rear bag and you can slide that up underneath the stock and you know, rest the buttstock on that bag so that when you shoot, you know, you've got support. That right there will make your gun steady, and it'll make the reaction of the gun correct, and it will make everybody's life easy.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one.
Obviously, that can be done from the bench. That could be done prone. You mentioned you use that when you're in the field as well.
Yeah, I do. Absolutely, it's absolutely mandatory. There's no situation where that is not required. And the same principle applies if you do shoot from a sitting position. Say that there's a 500-yard window of opportunity and you're in some brush and you can't get prone, but you've got a great set of sticks or a tripod that you can rest the front on and you're prepared. You also need to support the back end. Maybe you build your backpack frame up or whatever, and you support the back end. The same principle applies whether you're prone, you know, with a bag or sitting, you know, with 2 points to support. Adding that rear support is fundamental. The next biggest mistake is the guy's gun's too big. He's got a 300 Ultra Mag. Seriously, that's probably the absolute number one problem that people have to overcome.
Seems like, you know, so many guys are shooting the 300 Win Mags and everything today and maybe throwing on a muzzle brake to try and reduce that recoil. One question is, what are your thoughts on brakes for a hunting situation?
Absolutely. Do it. And don't be a cheapskate and put some dang earplugs in. You know what I mean? For about $15, you can get a set that have that little plastic band, so you can just pick them up right before it's time to shoot, and then you can shoot. The last few years, I've been using a pair of electronics. I think I spent about $650-$750 on them. So they're not the best ones that are out there. I did, like, my local ear guy did them for me. And literally, I have my little Kuyu binocular pouch, and those poke down in that little mesh, you know, expanding mesh on the side. It's like I just take those out and put them in, kick the sound on when we're kind of making a stock, and then when it's actually time to get set up and shoot, it's like they're already in. So what the recoil, what all those efforts to reduce recoil do is they help you shoot better psychologically, and they help you follow through on the shot and see the impact. And sometimes, you know, you can save a hunt. Let's say you're not quite rested right, you slip one over his back, it slips right over his back. And which is common. High impacts are common because of mistakes that we make with bipods and rear bags. So you miss one high, and you see that. And before the spotter can even respond, you've already reloaded, and you're already back on it, and you've corrected your mistake, and you take another shot, and you take that animal before he can even decide that he wants to leave. So it's like that muzzle brake is a good add. When I started, I was anti-muzzle brake. As I've learned and changed and seen the effect and what it can do for people, I'm all for it. It's an easy thing to do that can really enhance performance.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that's primarily beneficial on those larger calipers, or do you think there's enough advantage on, you know, those, 270s and, you know, the non-magnums, the non-big bore stuff?
My favorite caliber over the past 10 years, my favorite one is a little thing called the 6XC. That stands for Cross the Course. David Tubb invented that to compete in 1,000-yard competition where they shoot like 600-yard targets and 1,000-yard targets. And essentially, he's competing against, you know, that mentality of 300 Win Mag, you know, heavy is better. And then all of a sudden, you know, somebody introduces the 6.5 284, and that really starts cleaning clock on the big 30s. And then taking that same mentality and stepping it down one more, cut half the recoil out of it, and still get almost all of the same performance and wind, and see the advantage in your score. It's an exceptional round. Hornady just introduced the new 6 Creedmoor, which is essentially the same thing. And both of those are the same as a 243. They're just 150,000 shorter, approximately. And so similar velocities. But those cartridges have no recoil. The gun that I've shot, my gun that I built for myself in that 6XC, had a muzzle brake. Now, the last couple years, I'm doing all suppressors. So yeah, it's a whole nother story. But that muzzle brake definitely can be an advantage, even on the small cartridges.
This is a bit off topic, at least off topic according to my outline, but since you mentioned it, do you think there's traction towards legalizing suppressors and getting them out of NFA regulations? I know that, you know, there's Hearing Protection Acts and all kinds of benefits being touted even for the hunting community. Do you see that going anywhere with maybe the new administration?
You know, I don't know why it wouldn't go through. We have Donald Trump Jr. is, you know, I mean, he is a shooter and he is a hunter and he's a sportsman. He gets it. I mean, he's just as much a gearhead as all the rest of us guys. And I've heard him speak and I have a feel for where his position is. I mean, if he can't catch the presidents here, nobody can. But the problem is we've got to get the Congress on board. And they're still a bunch of the same politicians as they always have been. They're not like Donald Trump. Just because he's there doesn't mean they're going to follow. And they've got their little peccadilloes about, you know, how they pass bills. When you talk to the suppressor guys, they're hopeful, but I think they're only giving it about a 25% chance of going.
Mm.
Which is totally unfortunate, because if that would come off, it within 5 or 6 years, we would see suppressor cost, you know, in that $250 to $300 range.
Yeah.
Everybody would have suppressors, everybody would run them, and we'd become like the European countries where you're kind of rude a little bit if you show right. up and shoot without one. You know yeah. what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I don't think it's worth waiting to buy one. Right now, Silencer Co. is paying your $200 tax stamp if you buy a suppressor from them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you can get out of that whole $200, and it's like it makes a hard argument for why you would wait. If the HPA passes, the first few years, 3 years, potentially 3 years, you will see suppressor prices go through the roof, and mm-hmm. availability will be non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those things aren't going to be selling for $1,000. They're going to be selling for $1,500, $1,800 and up. And then you'll see a flood of other manufacturers come in and build a bunch of cheap stuff. Then you'll see a lot of, and so the prices will come down. You'll see a lot of that stuff blow up. Those guys will disappear. Everything will kind of start settling out. And then you'll see the prices just start to, you know, consistently creep down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I hope it goes through, but it's not an excuse to wait. It's like everybody should be on the suppressor bandwagon, in my opinion, right now. And everybody should own at least one in a 30 cal, like a Thunderbeast Ultra 7 in a 30 cal. That is a lightest weight suppressor that you can get with the most dB suppression, at least to my knowledge. That's the ones we like to run a bunch of. That's, you should own one of those, and you can run it on every single gun that you got that's smaller than your 30. Mm-hmm. Run it on your 7s, your 6.5, your 6s. And while you're at it, shorten your barrel up so you don't look like one of those guys with a 35-inch barrel sticking out.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. It could be exciting for sure. I think, you know, as you mentioned, it's funny when you think of Europe and, you know, we think we're so free and such a gun culture, but then you look there and it's like, obviously, in general, access to firearms is much different there. But, yeah, it's the norm. Like, it's the de facto there to have those firearms suppressed.
Well, it's kind of funny, though. In France, they're illegal. In Switzerland, they're mandatory.
All right, so let's dive into a bit more about gear, and I would love to really just learn more and discuss, you know, moving beyond, you know, the standard hunting rifle the guy picks up at a big box store, and begin to understand the differences, the advantages, and everything that goes into these long range, more accuracy focused, more specific. Weapon systems. I know that, you know, we could dive into individual traits, but really to begin with, talk us through the system ideology as a whole. Because really, I mean, as I see it, that's what you do with Gunworks. It's not just here's a really good barrel or here's a really good stock, but it's more about putting a package together, making sure that everything works and integrates well, and reaping the benefits of, you know, the proverbial, you're only as good as your weakest link. So you could have a great, you know, barrel on a poor chassis type deal. So help us understand a system and accuracy from that perspective.
Well, let's maybe a good way to contrast it, if we just say, okay, why spend $9,000 with Gunworks or $10,000 or whatever the final, you know, nut is. Why spend that with Gunworks instead of going and buying a Ruger American, you know, and a Leopold, you know, VX1 from my local shop? What's the difference? They both shoot bullets. And I think you touched on it there a little bit. It's the concept of the system. And let's crudely define the system as a combination of ammunition, rifle scope, and in our respect, we also add the range finding component there. And that kind of adds that ballistic element. So combining those pieces together in a symbiotic package that, you know, that's pre-fit and pre-configured and, you know, datted and put together and tested so that it actually functions and works. So it basically cuts out all those intermediate steps of doing it yourself. And, you know, the pratfall with doing it yourself is not that you can't, because, I mean, we've built our whole reputation on providing that information. You look at all of our, you know, our TV shows, it's showing you how to do it. All those YouTube videos, it's showing you how to do it. So it's not, we're not trying to hold anything proprietary, because we know everybody's smart enough to figure this out. And we've put out information to help them, you know, figure it out expeditiously and straightforward. But it's like, it takes time. And there's ways to screw it up. Let's say you buy a Browning, an Able, and those guns are awesome. I love those guns. The engineering's great. Know a lot of the guys that work there. And you buy that Browning, and it's a 300 Win Mag, and you want to shoot Burger 190 grain VLDs, or you want to shoot, say, one of those new Hornady ELDXs because it's got, you know, better terminal performance. So you go that bullet, and you find that when you seat the bullet to fit in the magazine, I mean, it almost is past the body portion of the bullet, and it's so far away from the lens, you know, it doesn't shoot well. And so if you seat the bullet out closer to the lens, and so you find this load that tunes up better, well, now you can't put your cartridges in the magazine box. So when I talk about a system, and that's actually a common thing, the SAMI length for a 300 Win Mag is just fine if you're using standard round blunt bullets, but when you put a VLD bullet in there, it doesn't work with their magazine box shapes. So when I talk about a system, I'm not talking about just the fact that it's got a scope mounted on it and it shoots a bullet. I'm talking about every single part and piece and configuration is engineered and sized correctly to do exactly what you want to do. And so you don't have to run into those, you know, those kind of those stumbling blocks along the way that, you know, don't shut you down completely, but definitely slow down, you know, the implementation of the system. So there's a really big difference in the fact that it's a turnkey, ready-to-go package. I would argue that, you know, our guns aren't really that much more accurate than, say, you know, one of the good ones that come off the line from Ruger or Remington or Browning. I've seen plenty of those guns that will shoot right along with ours for precision, you know, group size. So again, you're not picking, you know, the $9,000 spend because of the size of groups that you can shoot. You know, you could go buy three Brownings, you know, pick the one that shoots good out of the three, take the other two and put them on, you know, on the classifieds and sell them at $100 discount as a brand new gun, and, you know, end up with a, you know, kind of a range certified version of the Browning, and have an excellent shooting rifle. So the other thing that you're getting out of, you know, spending the big dollars, and I'm not just on a Gunworks, but other guns, is you get different components than those mass manufacturers are doing. They want to sell 20 or 30,000 of this model. So they'll create dimensions and configurations they feel will fit the mass market. When you go start looking at long range, the first knee-jerk thing that everybody wants to do is go buy a Macmillan A-series type stock. And that's the granddaddy of the long-range rifle stock. But it's also the granddaddy. I mean, the design is so old. It's not a high-performance design at all. But you look for that vertical grip and, you know, a little wider forend and stuff like that. But when you buy an engineered system like a Gunworks, it's like we've designed the stocks to do a very specific thing. And the most significant thing about a rifle in your experience is the stock design. A good example, we had a customer that built two 338 Lapuas, And one of them used our LR1000 stock, and I thought this guy was crazy for doing this, but he did it. And you know, sometimes you just let the customer make the decisions. he built the other one on a competitor's long range stock in that traditional style, vertical grip, etc. And it's like, it's the stock that everybody wants to use for long range. And you sit down and shoot those two, same gun, same weight, you know, same cartridge, everything. And you shoot that LR1000 stock, and it was pleasant. I mean, it had some juice to it, but it was pleasant. The recoil didn't hurt you. You could follow through on the gun. You could see the impacts. When you turn around and shoot on that next one over, it was brutal. It was absolutely brutal. It was such a night and day experience. And that type of experience is one of the things we expose our guys to in that level one course, is we'll stack up 20 different guns and different stocks and let you grab a hold of a gun. Maybe you want to shoot a 4-pound gun. Okay, so shoot one. And that'll be the only time you ever want to shoot one again, you know, and you'll grab the big tacticals and the heavy guns and this and that, and you can fit these different stocks, and you'll understand, you know, we'll present the science behind stock design and why certain shapes and certain features give you certain performance characteristics, and then let you go shoot them and see for yourself and feel. But it's like that knowledge of design translates into products that people can use, and combining that with a system, like, for example, like our rifle system. I mean, we have 3D models of the entire thing. I mean, we've modeled and developed and prototyped the entire package. And, you know, the guys at Ruger and Browning and stuff do that as well. But those guys that are right in the middle that are doing custom guns, they don't. They just go buy off the shelf the components, maybe, you know, whatever, you know, whatever they put them together, and they'll run into some of those fitment issues. They'll run into the limitations of that stock design that's 30 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of people that haven't shot anything different don't know any better that there's a whole new world of performance out there waiting for them.
Yeah.
So, you know, making decisions on equipment, you know, finding out understanding the things that really matter is kind of a challenge, because you don't know until you know. And once you find those things out, then you can start making those decisions wisely, and you can pick up that correct gear and put it together.
Yeah.
But I love like that, and I've been on kind of a mission of picking up some of these cool guns. That Ruger American rifle is an exceptional piece of manufacturing for the money that you spend to get it.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, I own one. I mean, I can build $10,000 guns all day long, but I've got one of those Ruger Americans. So just, you know, every gun doesn't need to be the perfect gun. You know, some of them can be perfect for what you need it for.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by the stock and the difference in performance. I mean, typically when we hear, you know, all things being equal, you know, caliber and barrel length and things of that nature, that certainly the heavier gun will have less recoil simply because there's more mass to move. And the lighter gun, since there's not much mass to move, that energy is going to go into you, the shooter. But I'm just curious. I know we could probably take an engineering course here, but from a higher level, how do you design stocks for performance specifically, as you mentioned, like in that 338 Lapua example? And how does recoil get managed through a stock simply beyond weight?
It's really, this is really hard for people to visualize, but think about physics. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. When that bullet accelerates down the barrel, what is your barrel and your action doing? It's going the other direction, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now that your barrel and action is coming back at you, how do you keep that from hitting you in the face, right? You bolt a stock onto it, and you hold onto that stock just tight as heck and push forward on it. So you've got this line of action with that, you know, down the center line of that barrel, you know, coming back at you. So you got this mass and this movement, and you're pushing forward on your stock, but you're not pushing right in line with that barrel. Like, mm-hmm. You're pushing below.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The center of your pressure on the recoil pads below, and the distance between those two lines of action, those forces, creates what we call a moment arm. And if one's going back this way and one going forward this way, you can see that it would just rotate.
Mm.
And that's where we get this thing called muzzle rise. Mm-hmm. Imagine what would happen. And you get this in certain if you move that recoil pad all the way up so that it's in line with the barrel. Would the barrel rise anymore? It wouldn't. A lot of the unpleasantness that you sense about recoil isn't necessarily the push on the recoil pad. It's the slap in the face that you get from the comb of the stock. So if you eliminate the muzzle rise, now all of a sudden it stops hitting you in the face. Another thing you can do is all of our stocks have a negative comb, which means from the heel, which is the butt pad, to the nose, which is up closer to the action, we have a slope or a drop of about a quarter of an inch. So it actually tapers away from your face. So if you've anchored your face on that stock, when you shoot, it actually pulls away, you know, as it recoils back, it pulls away from your face. You know, another thing that you can do is the dimension on the bottom of the stock, butt stock, is called the toe line. And that is, you know, on traditional American design, the toe line intersects kind of the rear screw right behind the trigger. That's exactly the wrong place to put it. If you look at like our Magnus design, go on our website, you look at our Magnus design, we've lowered that toe line down. It's not completely flat, but it's a lot flatter. Now imagine riding that on a rear bag where you've got a little cheek pressure and a little weight pushing down. When you shoot on a traditional stock, that butt stock's going to drop, and that's going to let the barrel rise, and you're going to be looking up in the sky. On this one, with that butt stock sitting down in the bag, when you shoot, it's going to track back straighter on that bag and allow you to see and push back into that gun and see that impact and follow through better. So, you know, just the way that you shape the forend, how you do the grip, you know, force people to put their thumb on the hand side of the grip rather than letting them have a stock design that makes them want to grip it, choke it up. If you cross the center line with your thumb, you're making one of the common mistakes people do, trying to control the gun. So the stock design can do so many things. As far as forcing people into good shooting habits, as far as reducing that felt recoil, as far as the follow-through and seeing your impacts, the stock's the secret to the whole deal. You take that stock design and you combine it with the right barrel contour and balance, all of a sudden you've got a gun that handles like a dream and shoots like a dream and helps you hit targets and helps you call your shots instead of a stock that beats you up and makes you hurt. And unfortunately, the design, and well, fortunately for me, the design guys in all of these big shops don't understand. as soon as they understand and they make a $1,000 rifle that performs and feels as good as mine does, then I'm in trouble. But I don't see that happening anytime soon.
So we don't need to edit that out?
No, you can let that roll.
Sounds like a challenge. No. Well, this has been awesome, Aaron. I want to respect your time for sure, and we've covered some great ground. But before we wrap up, I would love to, you know, we've talked a bit about the rifles, and there's so much more we could discuss from, you know, the action. I mean, you guys do crazy stuff. I encourage all the listeners to go check out the Gunworks site, but I wanted to talk about, and you hinted at this in the whole package, if you will. I want to talk about G7, what that means from that ballistics piece you mentioned is obviously so important, and how that works with the optics as well as the range finding offerings that you have with sure. your rifle setups through Gunworks.
So the G7 brand, we set up to be kind of a collaborative. And in one way, we collaborated with Night Force to build a product specifically for long-range hunters. And then in another sense, we collaborated with Laser Technologies in Denver to do a rangefinder that was also geared specifically for long-range hunters. And I've always been a big fan of the ballistic turret. You know, a dial where you can adjust to yards. Just it solves problems in how people make corrections, and it's not needed for every shot situation, and not everybody needs it, but there are certain hunting situations where it's the difference between success and failure, and that's why. And we actually have both. We have MOA numbers on the bottom of our turrets, and bullet drop compensating numbers on the top of the turrets. So essentially, we just dial out of the range. The problem with that is it's set for a flat fire situation and a very specific elevation of temperature. Let's say, for instance, 5,000 feet, 50 degrees. You have to have a rangefinder interface anyway. So what we did was we did a rangefinder that measures your incline, and when you measure the range, it also measures the pressure and temperature, and then it's got a little computer in there, and it does a ballistic correction and tells you, hey, look, you know, the distance is 800 yards, but because of the change in conditions, you need to shoot as if it's only 720. And so, again, we're just thinking in terms of yards so that I reach up there and I dial that turret to 720 yards. And you pull the trigger. We've fixed the elevation correction. The rangefinder will also give you a wind chart for that shot solution, you know, 5, 10, 15 mile an hour wind. And then you can just estimate your bracket, and then you hold the minutes in your reticle. It's a very simple solution, and it's very easy to train people for. And the thing that I've seen is, you know, and competition's fine, and I see a lot of guys coming up, that are trying to achieve the same thing. And, you know, they're bolting together systems with off-the-shelf, you know, components, and then they're, you know, finding a way to put a BDC turret on a scope and then selling that to the customer. And if the customer is not savvy, he might not realize that he's missing some key components to that system, and specifically that rangefinder can be the make or break in some of those 700 yard plus shots. You know, a little incline, a little air density change. And I mean, you could easily have 3 foot of error with a very simple change in temperature over the course of a day at 1,000 yards. So the rangefinder thing is, it's just one of those convenience tools. And if you look at all the things that we design and build, rather than just buying things off the shelf, it's basically my retirement money has gone into designing products rather than, you know, investment funds. But if you look at all those things that we build, the focus is, how do we remove things that could cause a failure for a client, for a customer? You know, things like our ammo that we load gets temperature stable powders. There's other powders that are easier to make shoot good or cheaper or more readily available. We don't use those because we want a powder that gives us the same velocity no matter what the temperature is. That way the customer is not out there trying to correct, you know, in the afternoon for the elevated temperature for this shot. You know, all you got to do is just range it, dial it, you know, dope your wind, hold it steady, break the trigger, dead. So that's what, you know, that G7, those products, that's what they're all about.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Very cool.
So the Gunworks website, of course, you've mentioned what hundreds of YouTube videos. Where else should listeners go, whether they just want to see more of their products, learn more about the information, because you guys have really put out some great content. Kind of give us the rundown on where listeners can not only follow what Gunworks is up to, but be more informed.
You know what? The internet's so full of great information, but unfortunately, it's buried under mounds and mounds of bullcrap. I mean, it truly is. And if you're willing to put on your hip boots and go start and shoveling,
yeah,
you can find some good information. But if you don't know, then how can you sort out the good stuff from the BS?
For sure.
If you go to a forum site like longrangehunting.com, I think that's like a go-to place. But again, there's a lot of BS there. It really is. But there's a lot of connections, right, that can send you to different manufacturers and different potentials and possibilities. But, I mean, a phone call and taking a few minutes to chat with one of our guys, you know, you can learn a lot. You know, looking at our videos, you can learn a lot. Our systems and the way that we've configured them, even though there's lots of options, I mean, there's a rifle builder on our site. You can pick a model that kind of fits your preferences, your style of hunting and shooting. And then there's literally 80 million different ways to configure a rifle on our website, and you can check them all out. But if you look at kind of where those options are, you can kind of start getting a feel for, you know, the type of stocks, the barrel contours, the weight and balance, the cartridges, the bullet types. You know, even just building some guns there will let you know, you know, a lot about, you know, the right directions to go. But, you know, watching those videos, we do a TV show you can watch. We do a magazine quarterly magazine you can subscribe to, or check out the blog there. Other trusted people out there in the business, you know, search some of those guys out that have great reputations and follow what they're doing. But I mean, the best advice is understand the equipment, why you make those selections, not just because so-and-so has it, but what's the science behind it. Get the smallest cartridge that you can possibly talk yourself into. Everybody thinks you need 300 Ultra Mags. Get something smaller, 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 smaller. And bottom line is, like, just go get a 7 Rem Mag and everybody will be happy. just if you can get that information, truly invest $1,000 to come spend a couple days with us, shoot our guns, burn our ammo, and have a great time. And we'll teach you everything you need to know to go out there and find the equipment you want and set it up yourself and be, you know, light years down the path from the guy that, you know, doesn't make that investment. We'll save you $1,000 easy. We'll save you $1,000 in bad decisions.
Yeah. So the courses, at least like the level ones, around $1,000, and that includes the equipment and ammunition?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, the whole course.
Wow. Yeah, that seems like a great educational opportunity for sure. As you said, going to save money down the line.
Sure, and you can get exposed to a lot of gear. And truthfully, that's probably one of the other places that you would go, not just sitting there doing internet research, but go to the range. You know, find a shooting event. Go check out one of those PRS competitions. And, you know, understand that those guys build guns for different purposes. And, you know, absolutely no way am I packing a 14-pound gun. But it's like you can get a lot of information in, you know, face-to-face type stuff. Trade shows is another place. Those are good spots to look.
Awesome. Well, Aaron, we appreciate the time so much. Just thank you for joining us and sharing this information with us.
You're welcome. I think we hit about 0.1% of the information that I felt like I needed to share. So,
we can always come back and knock out another 0.1%, and we'll be a little bit more there.
Twice as much.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks, Aaron.
All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for tuning in to this episode. Hope that you are subscribed to get all future episodes, including the big 100th episode giveaway coming soon. Again, if you have any questions, comments, feedback, shoot us an email to podcasts@exomountaingear.com. We look forward to hearing from you soon. Getting back for episode 99, it's going to be a fun one, and then the big giveaway for 100. Talk to you soon.